I'm Jim DeRogatis, pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kott. I'm the pop music critic at the Chicago Tribune.
And the two of us host a show on public radio called Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show.
How do you think these guys, Simon and Garfunkel, you know, found a way to be major stars in this era that you were basically just describing, an era of guitar bands, experimentation, you know, hard soul music? And what was in Simon and Garfunkel's blend that was somehow appealing at the time and to audiences, and then your own take on it?
Well, I think there was a certain comfort level with Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, it was kind of like warm milk and cookies, you know, at the time. I mean, they wrote, Simon wrote wonderful melodies, and Garfunkel had this beautiful crooner's voice. So in a lot of ways, there was an element here of old school, you know, pop that was comforting to a lot of listeners. But people who were looking for the cutting edge of rock music in the late 60s weren't turning to Simon and Garfunkel records.
But I think Greg, that a timeless melody is timeless. You know, it appeals to people at any point. And the way that those two voices could harmonize, and we have to give much of the credit to Garfunkel, because, you know, Simon does not have a great voice on his own, but he did fill out Garfunkel's. You know, it was just an impossible thing not to admire. You could look at them and say, these guys are pretty square. They look square, they sing square, and even when they're trying to be hip, you know, they're still pretty square. But you know, you just had to love the way those guys sang together and the way Simon crafted those hooks.
Well, even, you know, I think that's the key. The melodies were inescapable. But I think Simon went on to do much, much better work, much more creative work as a solo artist almost immediately after Simon and Garfunkel broke up. He was yearning to do something with a little bit more rhythmic pulse to it. And he finally got that opportunity on the last Simon and Garfunkel record with songs like Cecilia. But it really started to manifest itself on his solo recordings. And I think that's kind of what's lacking here. There was a lack of groove, a lack of rhythmic drive, a lack of inventiveness in terms of what they could do with the sound of these kind of Tin Pan Alley songs that Simon was writing. Influenced by doo-wop, Tin Pan Alley, brill-building pop, with a great voice in Garfunkel as a vehicle, but a limited voice in that Garfunkel was pretty much a straight-up crooner. He really didn't have the versatility to sing, you know, kind of grooving, rhythmically adventurous kind of songs. And I think when Simon's songwriting really started to flourish when he went out on his own and didn't have to write specifically for Garfunkel's voice anymore.
I think one of the appeals of these two records, though, is that there's a certain melancholy happening, which, again, you know, we tend to romanticize this time through rose-colored glasses and say everything is peachy, but there were frightening ramifications of looking into the future. You know, a lot of people were jumping off the edge and leaping, you know, bravely, not knowing where they were going to land. But and I think Simon and Garfunkel were, you know, being a little older and a little more conservative and having their roots in doo-wop and in the folk movement earlier, before rock, they were a little frayed. And I think that comes through, you know. I think that there's, you know, Hello Darkness, My Old Friend is kind of like permeating those two albums.
Yeah, what is the connection to the folk scene in, you know, maybe those first three or four albums? Because, I mean, you were saying connection to doo-wop and brill building, but there's clearly some Dylan influence and some, you know, New York folk scene influence too.
Absolutely. I think Simon was coming out of doo-wop and brill building and Everly Brothers. Those were the things that were kind of influencing his music, but folk music was in the air. It was kind of the coin of the realm at the time. Dylan was huge. Simon was, you know, somewhat miscast as a Dylan wannabe or a Dylan imitator or a Dylan acolyte when in fact he was none of those. He even wrote a song that kind of dissed Dylan. I'm trying to find the name of that song, but it had that odd title. You know what I'm talking about, Paul?
It's the long title.
He even wrote a song that dissed Dylan, called "A Simple Desultory Philippic," which was, you know, on the Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme record, and it was just one of those things where you kind of, come on, Paul, you don't have to protest so righteously here that, you know, okay, you know, you're in a different league. Dylan was just, you know, Midwestern. His roots were there. Simon's roots were much more urban. And you could hear that very clearly as he proceeded through his career and into his solo records. But during the phase of that second, third, and fourth records, I mean, he was definitely crafting folk pop type of songs because that was what the currency was at the time. And I think that was kind of limiting to him because I think there was a lot more there that came out in his solo recordings.
Is there a songwriting high point and low point of these two or three albums, do you think, for Simon as a writer?
I just think it was very precious. I look at a song like The Dangling Conversation from Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, and you read your Emily Dickinson and I my Robert Frost, and we note our place with bookmarkers that measure what we've lost. You know, this is the kind of stuff that, poetry students in high school write, and they think it's profound. But even Simon now will tell you, I look back on that stuff and I realize it's a boy writing these things. It doesn't hold up. And I know a lot of people revere these songs, but as I said, I think he really matured as a songwriter later on.
And is there anything, though, that gives a peek to his budding maturity in this period, like a peek ahead?
I think the great stuff starts to come in with album number four, the Bookends record, where he and Roy Halley started to use the studio as another sound in the production. The production became a bigger part of the songwriting, and I think they started to experiment more with ideas in the studio. And I think there's at least a couple of really classic songs on that record. Straight up classics. Mrs. Robinson, I think, is a timeless song, and Hazy Shade of Winter. And it's interesting that those two songs were later covered by relatively notable groups, later on, much later on. Mrs. Robinson covered by the Lemonheads, and Hazy Shade of Winter, the Bangles covering that song. So I think they could hear that Simon's songwriting had sort of stepped up and become more rhythmically relevant. Those are the kind of songs that spoke to subsequent generations in a way that maybe some of those more precious folk songs did not.
I'll give you another one, Greg. I think that I've always been blown away by Yes's cover of America.
America, yeah.
I think America is an incredible song. It is Simon at his best. I think that's the big hint towards the maturity that's coming. You know, this idea we've all gone to look for America.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's the connection to the folk era in the a lot of the early folk in New York, especially Dylan when he came to Greenwich Village, were coming out of Kerouac and the Beats and this notion of the road and traveling and crossing this great country, and that's where you're going to find the heart and soul of America, especially in a year like 67, 68, that whole period. You have Easy Rider but there's also a darkness out there in America. I can go through these two or three albums we're talking about by Simon and Garfunkel and choose the fine moments. And like I said, they tend to be the more melancholy, dark ones. I mean, even something like Scarborough Fair, which is a bit of a wistful look mm-hmm. at this kind of, almost fairy tale setting, storybook setting. But there's the kind of minor key ominous sound. I don't know if it was like Garfunkel and that choir boy voice. I mean, you keep calling him a crooner, but it's more like the twisted choir boy or something. But there's a darkness in those songs. There's a darkness even in America. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike. That's not a romantic image. It's an ugly. Anybody who's ever taken the New Jersey Turnpike from New York City to Newark Airport and gone past the gas tank farms of Elizabeth and the belching smokestacks and Port Newark. I mean, that is the ugliest underside of America. And this is what, Garfunkel and Simon are singing about in that song.
Right.
I think that that's a beautiful moment, but that could just be because I grew up in Jersey City.
Greg, you kind of touched on what Paul Simon seemed to be anxious to do when he did break out and do his own albums. Anything else about those first couple albums that strike you as either interesting or strengths or weaknesses?
Well, like I said, I think it's difficult for me to go back and play those early records and not hear sort of the wannabe poet in there. I think the poetry is rather obvious, the protest, as it were, in a song like Sounds of Silence.
I guess I'm jumping ahead to the first two solo records.
Yeah, well, I think with the first two solo records, Simon's development really explodes. I mean, I think his vision was always to sort of write sophisticated adult pop songs with great grooves. And he really wasn't able to pull that off with Simon and Garfunkel. But on his own, he really succeeded. He was able to indulge himself. I mean, think about it. You look at a song like Mother and Child Reunion coming out in the early 70s, and there's a reggae groove on this, you know? There weren't a whole lot of reggae songs on the American airwaves in the early 70s. And here Paul Simon, one of the most wealthiest pop stars on the planet at the time, experimenting with this kind of, you know, non-traditional groove in a song. Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. You know, really cool percussion on that song, a wicked whistling solo. I mean, those are kind of like cool little touches.
I'll give you another one, Greg, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover later on. You know, when Steve Gadd played on that song, as a drummer, I've never been a musician, but I'm a drummer. You know, drummers worship that song. The polyrhythmic snare drum thing that Steve Gadd set up on that song is considered, if you can master that as a drummer, you've arrived.
It's a drumming masterclass.
Few people can. Yep. I think it's really interesting that Simon, who's this known as this melodic craftsman, right from the start of his solo career, it was the rhythm that was most intriguing him. And then obviously that leads to an explosion of stuff later on when you get to records like Graceland.
Yeah, absolutely. Rhythm of the Saints, Graceland. You could all hear it coming out of those first two solo records. You know, you listen to a song like Loves Me Like a Rock, which I just love. It's a pure up, straight up gospel song. It's like he went to some church, Baptist church in the South, and came back inspired by what he heard and turned it into a pop song. And that was the genius of Simon on those first couple of solo records.
Well, Simon, in like 1980s interviews, basically declared melody dead. You know, he said it's all rhythm now.
That makes him a hip hopper.
Well, you know, I guess that is a good segue to, you know, kind of listen to and talk a little bit about what you hear on Graceland, because I think that's what people comment about, particularly like right out of the box with, is it Boy in the Bubble that just starts that album out with just this incredibly thick rhythmic track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his, he went to South Africa to work with these musicians, and he knew what he wanted. He wanted to work with, a strong rhythmic foundation, and he went to South Africa to find it. And, the bass lines, I think people will be studying the bass lines on the Graceland record long after those songs are forgotten. I mean, not that those songs are bad, but the bass lines are just amazing. It really is one of the great bassline records of all time. So it really started from the bottom up, and Simon had never had a foundation quite like that ever before to work with, and that's why people love those songs. I mean, you can dance to that music even if you're not even paying attention to the words.
What do you think allowed Graceland to strike such a responsive chord with the audience in the mid-80s? Did it have to do with what else was happening musically, or was there something else about it that, you know, you guys think really broke through?
I think, you know, if you look at the African musicians that Paul Simon was working with, I've heard this from so many of them that I've interviewed. They talk about that experience where, you know, they would hear over American radio or Radio America and the BBC, they'd hear this American music, and their imaginations would be fired by doo-wop or early 50s rock or later on, 60s pop, even like Simon and Garfunkel. And then that would merge into what they were doing as African musicians, their traditional sounds in Africa. I think what Simon did here, and this is this debate has been going on since Graceland came out, was he was the artistic imperialist who traveled to this country and brought the sound back. I don't know that we can credit Simon for the incredible success of Graceland, except that he had very good taste and presented this music. I think what people were really responding to in that album was this world of music that they hadn't been hearing. And it was presented by a guy that they were very familiar with. Greg called Simon and Garfunkel earlier milk and cookies. You know, what could be less threatening? We know this guy. We love this guy. He writes, nice tunes. And here he is introducing us to this world of music, this world music that America was not hearing, and unjustly so. You know, I mean, the musicians in Africa had taken from America, and now they were ready to give back, and America was, was taking, but it was taking from Paul Simon without really thinking about the African musicians.
some of the other commentators I've talked with comment on, you know, his writing style, that it's puts a lot of thought into how songs start, that they're sort of an engaging, and he himself talks about a turn in his writing style around Hearts and Bones and Graceland to a much more kind of conversational, ambiguous, you know, both sides of an argument type of writing style. Is there anything about the, you know, what he's writing about and how he's writing that seems different or seems interesting to you guys from that point on?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think his writing got better, and I think he's one of the songwriters that has actually, you know, continued to improve at his craft. I mean, a lot of people may think, well, the songs he's writing now aren't as good as the ones he wrote for Simon and Garfunkel, and I would disagree with that. They're not as popular. But I think his songwriting has actually become more sophisticated and more intriguing as he goes along. And I think the Graceland album is a good example. That sort of off the cuff nature of a song like You Can Call Me Al. I mean, it's almost a toss off. It sounds almost trivial, but there's a lot of craft behind that song. And one of the reasons it remains so popular when he performs it in concert, I think it does have that sort of playfulness that wasn't there before. So I think that was an interesting development in his songwriting, that he was able to drop some of that earnestness and that self-seriousness that was just, to me, really choked off a lot of those Simon and Garfunkel songs from being really enjoyable. And to finding that joy in a song like You Can Call Me Al, or even the sarcasm of I Know What I Know, something like that, from Graceland. I think those were really positive steps in his songwriting.
I'm glad you mentioned the word self-serious and pompous and earnest, Greg, because, yeah, Paul Simon is rather insufferable. You know, when you interview him, he is got an opinion of Paul Simon's place in the history of pop music. And he did take himself too seriously. And I think having been saddled early on with that, you know, part of the Dylan crew of folk musicians and you know, in the 60s, feeling like he had to make statements, you know, he was always trying to say something in his songs. I think with Grace, you're starting to see the guy just enjoying the sound of words. I mean, look, one of the other things that Dylan got from Kerouac is that words can just be beautiful. They don't have to mean anything. You can string them together because of the way they sound. And I think that Simon's starting to do that. But just look at the song titles, you know, Boy in the Bubble. There's a certain, just the way those words sound together. Gumboots, you know, mm-hmm. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. I think he's just stringing words together often just for the joy of saying them and singing them.